I'm Donald Hosegan. This is the Cancer Action New York teleconference. The scientific expert that we have joining us today is David O. Carpenter, MD. He's a public health physician. He's the director of the SUNY Albany Institute for Health and the Environment. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Don. Well, I'm happy to be able to talk about persistent organic pollutants. It's a subject I've worked with for a long period of time. Certainly not the only environmental agent I've worked with. I've done a lot with metals and with volatile organics as well. But I've been particularly caught up in the issue of persistent organic pollutants, particularly polychlorinated biphenols, PCBs, dioxins and furans, and chlorinated pesticides like DDT. Don had asked me to focus particularly on effects in children, although a lot of my current research is more focused on the chronic diseases of older age. So let me first talk about effects in children, and then perhaps if there's time to mention what we're doing at present. The issue with the persistent organic pollutants is that most of them are either known human carcinogens or probable human carcinogens. I was actually on the committee of the International Agency for Research on Cancer that met last February in Lyon, France, and upgraded the rating of PCBs from probable human carcinogens to known human carcinogens. And while the evidence is strongest for malignant melanoma, breast cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, there is certainly evidence that all kinds of cancer are increased by exposure to PCBs. Now, that is an issue for children because in many cases, children are more exposed than adults are for a variety of reasons. And while the cancers may not appear for years until they reach adulthood, the fact that their exposure can occur over the course of a lifetime, and particularly because these compounds stay in the human body for so long, this increases the risk of cancer as a result of childhood exposure. Let me say a little bit about that, because these compounds, and that's the whole range, the dioxins, furans, the PCBs, the chlorinated pesticides, because they have chlorines on the molecule, they are very resistant to being broken down. That's true in the environment, and that's true in animals in the human body. In human body, the half-life for both dioxins and PCBs is about 7 to 10 years, which means if you ate a contaminated fish for dinner last night, you'll still have half of the PCBs you got from that meal in your body 10 years from now. The health effects of concern are certainly not limited to cancer. And as a matter of fact, what we seem to be finding as we do more and more research on these compounds is that just about every organ system in the body is affected. A lot of my work has been focused on effects of chemicals that cause reductions in IQ and alter behavior. Lead has certainly been known to do that for many, many years, and we've instituted some fairly significant preventive strategies to reduce exposure to lead. We took it out of gasoline. We have taken it out of house paint, although there's still old houses that have it, and there still is lead dust along the roadways because of the many years that we added lead to gasoline. But PCBs do very much the same thing that lead does in terms of IQ. They cause a reduction of IQ that in highly exposed people can be about 5 to 7 IQ points. That evidence has been shown in many different studies. It was first shown in Taiwan in a population of people where the manufacturer of rice oil, the machine that made the rice oil had PCBs as lubricants. They leaked into the oil, and everybody was eating it without realizing it. And the major adverse health effect was in the children born to mothers that had eaten this contaminated rice oil. And they were found to have reduced IQ. Now, it wasn't that every child was, mentally retarded, not at all. It was just that the distribution of IQ in that population of exposed children was shifted downward by about 5 to 7 IQ points. While some of them were still relatively bright, because IQ is determined much more than just by contaminants, but none of them were as bright as they would have been had they not been exposed. In addition, and this is true just like it is for lead, PCBs appear to reduce attention span, and that may be one of the factors that's responsible for the IQ, because how can a kid learn if they can't pay attention? But also importantly, it reduces their ability to deal with frustration. So children with PCB exposure will exhibit all the signs of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. They will be problems in the school classroom. They will respond more likely with fits of anger when they're frustrated. And while it's not been clearly demonstrated for PCBs as it has for lead, there is certainly some evidence that people exposed in childhood to lead and probably PCBs are much more likely to be arrested for criminal behavior when they are older. The evidence is very strong for that for lead-exposed children, because they are more likely to be incarcerated. People in jails will tend to have much higher lead levels than people out. I don't think that anyone's ever done that yet for PCB levels, but I would predict you'd find the same association. So from a societal point of view, I think that's probably the most significant effect. It isn't a disease per se, but it's a dumbing down of the population. And it increases the risk of antisocial and violent behavior. In addition to that, there are other effects. Most of the persistent organics are endocrine disruptors. They change endocrine systems. We know most about the sex steroid systems and thyroid. And this gets complicated because both PCBs and dioxins are mixtures of different what we call congeners. For PCBs, there are a total of 209 different congeners. A PCB is a chemical, it's the biphenyl ring, which is basically two benzene rings coupled together. And there are 10 sites around the ring that contain either hydrogen, which is what biphenyl is, or chlorines. And so there can be a PCB can have one chlorine, or it can have 10 chlorines, or anything in between. And because there are these different sites around the molecule, the chlorines can be placed at different positions. Now, depending on how many chlorines and what positions they are around the molecule, they have different health effects. Some of them have activity like dioxin does. Dioxin's been known for a long time to be a carcinogen. It's also been associated with other diseases. But that's really a minority of the PCB congeners, and most of them do not have dioxin-like activity. However, they still have activity where they bind to receptors in cells that are called nuclear receptors, because they're receptors in the cytoplasm that when they're activated, they move to the DNA of the cell and they cause induction of genes. And that leads to this variety of health effects. The effects on the sex steroids are multiple. Some of them, and these are the dioxin-like ones, cause induction into cells of the P450 enzyme, the enzyme primarily studied in the liver, but it's in other cells as well. The one that breaks down and metabolizes estrogen. And so when people are exposed to This group of PCBs, they tend to be masculinized if they're female. And that actually may protect against breast cancer, but it's certainly not a good thing. Other PCBs and some other dioxins actually are weak agonists at estrogen receptors, so they cause estrogenic activity, and this tends to feminize, especially little boys. And that's been very clearly demonstrated in studies in the Netherlands, where they looked at little boys' playthings, and when they had high levels of PCBs, they tended to play with dolls rather than guns. And while some of my feminist friends think that's a good thing, and in some ways it may function to reduce the violent behavior that's so characteristic of males, it clearly is not a good thing because it's a perturbation of normal physiologic and gender-specific behavior. There's a big question about the role that these exposures will have in sexual preference. Not that that's a disease, but it's a perturbation of natural development if it is caused by exposure to environmental contaminants. Now, the effects on the thyroid gland are somewhat different because they don't seem to act through these nuclear receptors. Thyroid hormone is obviously very important. If you don't have thyroid hormone during development, you become a cretin with gross mental retardation. Unfortunately, PCB structure is very closely related to thyroxine structure. Thyroid hormones have iodines, not chlorines, but they have two benzene rings. In the case of thyroxine, that's coupled with an oxygen between the rings, but they look very much like PCBs. And PCBs, or at least some of the PCB congeners, actually bind to the thyroxine receptor, and more importantly, they bind to the proteins that carry thyroxine in the blood. And the result is that if thyroxine is not bound to its carrier protein, it is degraded by the liver. And so the general effect of high exposure to PCBs is you get hypothyroidism. And this we have demonstrated very convincingly in the Mohawk population, where the incidence of hypothyroidism, which is much more common in women than in men, but it's dramatically elevated in people with high levels of PCBs. Now, I should have said when I was talking about the IQ effects is that we've demonstrated this also in the Mohawk adolescents. My colleague Larry Schell, who had a major part of the big Superfund grant that I headed, looked at Mohawk children between the ages of 10 and 16 in relation to their PCB exposure, and their PCB levels were not extraordinarily elevated. They were pretty much what you would see in the general population, perhaps a little bit higher because the Mohawks tend to eat contaminated fish from the St. Lawrence River and its tributaries. But the higher the PCBs, the poorer the children would do on traditional IQ and memory tests. We also looked at adult Mohawks, and found that on a memory test, memory in the adults was also reduced if their PCB concentrations were elevated. So while the majority of the studies have been on childhood exposures, the adverse health effects are not limited to children. And again, this is a tragic thing when it dumbs down the population, and certainly IQ and ability to pay attention are critical factors for success in life. So the things that I've gone on to study since then are now looking at the more chronic diseases of older age. We've got a new study that's almost ready to be submitted on diabetes in the Mohawks. And one doesn't normally think of diabetes as being an environmentally induced disease, but in the last number of years, there's been a whole body of knowledge that says these persistent organics alter the risk of developing diabetes. And interesting, it's not just the persistent organics. There's some evidence that some metals do so also. And so I think a general surprising understanding that diabetes may be due to a variety of exposures. But our studies in the Mohawks, about 5 years ago, we did publish a paper in a subset of the Mohawks where we demonstrated that PCBs, if you look in the Mohawk population, they have quite a wide range of, these are now adults, they have quite a wide range of PCB concentrations that were related to how many fish they ate out of the St. Lawrence River and its tributaries because of the contamination that came from the three aluminum foundries there by General Motors, Elko, and Reynolds Metals. But those individuals that had high levels of PCBs had almost a fourfold greater risk of showing diabetes after adjustment for age and gender and obesity and so forth, as compared to the people that had the lowest levels. Well, we have now expanded our study. We have over 700 adult Mohawks, or at least Mohawks over the age of 18, and have looked very carefully at which of the PCBs seem to have this association. And we've come with a surprising finding that the strongest association is with the PCBs that have fewer chlorines that are not like the dioxin. And these PCBs, it's interesting that PCBs with few chlorines are more volatile and more water-soluble than those that have more chlorines. We have previously in the Mohawk population demonstrated that in the blood of younger Mohawks, we could see a pattern of PCBs that matched that we could measure in the air nearing the General Motors site. And now we're finding that pattern is the one that most closely is associated with the increase in diabetes. The implications of this, and it does need to be confirmed, but the implications I think are major because it suggests that breathing in PCBs is a very important route of exposure, at least for diabetes. And we previously had some results that indicated that this was true also for the effects on IQ and memory. We have also looked at some other diseases. We published about 4 years ago a paper that showed that the levels of cholesterol and triglycerides in blood in Mohawks were directly related to the exposure to PCBs. And I should have also said we measured three pesticides, DDE, the metabolite of DDT, hexachlorobenzene, and Myrex. And while the Mohawks are not unusually exposed to these pesticides, they certainly have exposure, as we all do. And in this study with the measurements of cholesterol and triglycerides, we found that the total PCBs, and especially the higher chlorinated PCBs, not the ones that are related to diabetes, as well as hexachlorobenzene and DDE, the metabolite of DDT, were all associated with elevated risk of having high cholesterol and high triglycerides. And it's certainly well documented that the greatest risk factor for heart disease is having high cholesterol and high triglycerides. Let me go back and talk about some of the effects that on children with these endocrine disruptors. I've forgotten whether I mentioned already that in the children, we found the higher the PCBs, the lower their thyroid hormones, in both children and adults. But we also looked at the onset, the age of onset of puberty in Mohawk girls, in relation to their concentrations of PCBs and also of lead. And what we find is that because PCBs have this estrogenic activity, the chance that a girl will reach puberty at a younger age is much greater if she has high PCB levels. In contrast, again, the Mohawk kids don't have particularly elevated levels of lead, but lead tends to delay the age of puberty. Again, this is not a disease, but age of puberty is important for a variety of social and psychological reasons, and these contaminants are just interfering and altering that age. Finally, we also looked in Mohawk men where we had measurements of testosterone level, the male sex hormone, and we found that the higher the PCB level, the lower the testosterone concentration in men. So PCBs have actions both on female sex hormones and male hormones, and in the case of the male hormones, they tend to reduce masculinity. In the case of the female hormones, they also tend to reduce masculinity because both males and females have both androgens and estrogens. So I think I should probably stop there and see if there are questions or other things I should comment on.
No, that's very interesting. I really appreciate your time. I've always suspected this. I've never, and I know there's a lot of literature on this, about the chemicals in the aquasazne.
Yeah, and the big frustration is, what do we do about it? Because they're so difficult
mm-hmm.
to remove.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got this big dredging project here in the Hudson River, and there's also been dredging up there in the St. Lawrence already. But it's so expensive. I think that's the issue, that the expense has to be balanced against these health effects.
Mm-hmm.
David,
and could you
give a little bit about the WHO report, Persistent Organic Pollutants Impact on Child Health, just the recommendation and, you know, why it came to be a good idea to minimize exposure to these chemicals, you know, across the world, you know, just making the point about it not only being a matter of the local exposures via the consumption of materials that come from contaminated sites and breathing the PCBs from contaminated sites, but this whole matter of the global food supply contamination?
Right. Well, and I should have done that already, Don, without you reminding me. But I think the things that we've seen at aquasazne and the Mohawks have been seen around the world. And the sources of exposure are not only, you know, the fish in the St. Lawrence or the air in Anniston, Alabama. These contaminants have permeated our food supply. They're present in almost all animal fats to some degree, so you can't use a slab of butter without getting some PCBs with it. The adverse health effects on the nervous system, on the hormonal system, on cancer, and now more recently on the chronic diseases of older age like diabetes and heart disease, these have been, they've been reported all over the world. And the problems, of course, are what steps can one take to reduce exposure? The remediation of the waste sites is very expensive. It's important. But for most people that don't live by waste sites, the primary source of exposure is their food supply. And this is something Don and I have talked about a lot and cared about a lot. The reality is that there should be no PCBs in plant sources. The exposure to PCBs in animal fats comes from what the animals eat. And most of the domestic animals, cattle in particular, are not normal carnivores. What has happened with modern agriculture is that when an animal is slaughtered, the waste fat is put back into the commercial food that's fed to feed animals. And after mad cow disease, we stopped feeding cow fat to cows, so now we feed it to pigs and chickens. We feed the pig and chicken fat mixed with grain, but in commercial mixtures, and feed that back to cows. And so we're recycling all these contaminants that of chemicals that, for the most part, we stopped making back in the 70s. But they're still spreading around, and in fact, the levels in the general population, while they went down quite dramatically when we first stopped manufacturing them, they've now plateaued at levels that still cause health effects. So the advice would be, you know, I think we need government regulation to stop this practice of feeding waste animal fats to animals that are in the food supply. The issue is, of course, that they grow faster if they have a lot of fat, and you have all this waste fat from slaughterhouses that is a cheap source of making the animal grow faster, but at the same time, that's the source of the exposure. The issue with fish is more complicated because fish are are growing in bodies of water, and of course they're going to, we've contaminated the sediments in the water, excuse me, and the fish are going to eat the worms and the mayflies and all the bugs and so forth, and so it's not easy to reduce the contaminants in fish. Now, I've also been involved in studies of farmed fish, especially farmed salmon, and there we found that farmed salmon had much higher concentrations of contaminants than did wild salmon. And again, the source of the exposure was the food the farmed salmon were fed, which was a concentrated fish meal, fish oil, where they take a big net and catch everything that swims in the ocean, concentrate it so you have 35 or so percent fat, and we've sufficiently contaminated the ocean that even these wild-caught fish, if you concentrate the oil, become a dangerous source of food. But the adverse health effects really are serious. They're not immediate, and this is one of the reasons why I think the public doesn't understand this very well. Because, you know, effects on IQ, it's hard to understand that that's from your chemical exposures. When you develop cancer or diabetes or heart disease or high blood pressure, all of these being related to exposure to these persistent organics, but they occur at later times than when you're exposed, and so the public doesn't really make that association.
Wow.
So I don't have any... And a quick and easy answer of what to do, but I do think this is an incredibly important issue that, you know, the medical community doesn't really understand.
They don't.
Most physicians,
they're
treating the diseases. They're not really often asked. It's an unusual physician that's asking the question of what caused this disease beyond smoking and things like that.
Mm-hmm. We do see a lot of diabetes. I know when I used to work with the Aquasazni, there just was a lot. And as you say...
Oh, yeah. I mean, in our studies, I think it's like 22% of the Mohawks over 18 have diabetes. That's sky high. I think the background
mm-hmm.
U.S. population is like 4 or 5%.
Well.
So it's a big problem.
Mm-hmm. As you say, I do see the girls seem to be younger.
Well, that's right. And, you know, we're seeing now, even in teenagers,
mm-hmm.
it used to be that you could tell whether it was type 1 or type 2 diabetes just on the age. Can't do that
yes.
any longer.
No.
And
mature onset of diabetes in the youth. You certainly do
right.
see a lot of that.
Well, I certainly appreciate your time.
No, I really appreciate all this information. Don and I had been talking, and he's very passionate about this and getting the information out there to people so that we can get together and change policy, whatever, or change process, or whatever we can do to make little changes.
Well, you certainly aren't going to make changes until people understand what the issues are. And that's why it is so important to have this kind of information.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I truly believe that once the people have this information, they will change their diet for the time being, you know, as the regulatory changes
right.
take place. Then eventually they may well choose to go back to eating, you know, the average usual consumption patterns for amounts of animal fat. But in the present moment, when the regulation doesn't exist and the food supply is contaminated, it's just a truly something that most people would want to do if they had the knowledge. They would want to avoid
right.
exposure, minimize the exposure to these chemicals.
Well, you know, I have some experience with that, because when our studies on farmed salmon first came out, the sale of Northern European farmed salmon, which is the most contaminated, fell by 50% for a few months, and then it slowly creeped back up. But the number of people that I run into that still will choose to pay a little more for wild salmon than to buy the less expensive farm salmon is significant. And, you know, so you just have to get information out and educate the public so that they can make more healthy choices.
I agree.
Well, I really appreciate your time, both you, Dr. Carpenter, and you, Ms. Karazi. It's very good to have people interested in working on these issues. It's wonderful.
Well, good to talk to you both, and Happy New Year.
Have a safe trip, and Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Happy New Year, both of you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.